run that half-hour tape from the BBC. Also, I think there were a couple of miscellaneous audio tapes that didn't get played in some of the presentations over the last couple of days. If the speakers want to play those, that can be done this afternoon there also. We'll make those arrangements ad hoc. Again, I remind you that for questions following the presentation, please use the floor mic so we can capture you for history also, and remind us what your name is. And of course, tapes will be available of these sessions as well as the ones held at the Carolina Hotel from conference tapes in Canada. Please patronize them if you want them to continue to do this for us each year. This morning's speaker, our first speaker this morning, is a recent member of ARSC who has been working on some very interesting discographical projects, and I think we're very fortunate to hear from him in his first major presentation on this project. He is a student at Columbia University, a senior, and also, if I can find my papers, yes, a former program director and director of operations and engineering at WKCR-FM, which is the Columbia University station. You may have noticed in the ARSC Journal, if you didn't, you certainly didn't look at the ARSC Journal, in the last one, a comprehensive discography of Emanuel Feuermann, which is by John Samuels. He's currently working on a discography of the Fonzoli Quartet, and this morning's presentation will be on Feuermann, John Samuels.
I figure I ought to answer a couple questions first, because I know that these are the ones that people normally ask, and I figure I ought to get them out of the way before anything else. The first question I'm always asked is, am I a cellist? And the answer is no. I'm a pianist, a pretty bad one, but I do play the piano, and I figure that that'll clear up something there. And the other thing that I wanted to mention beforehand is, for those of you who don't know Feuermann, whenever I make a presentation of this type to friends or to others who I'm trying to convince of the worthwhileness of what I've done, I always ask them, have you heard of Casals? Usually they answer yes, and so after that point I start to say, well, I think Feuermann's better, and then I try and explain why. All right. The other thing I wanted to say, just to preface it, is how I started at this discography. I'm usually asked that. I started this discography actually for WKCR, the Columbia station, in a backhanded sort of way. I was working at KCR a number of years ago, this is 1977, and at that time, I really wasn't able to do all that much. I felt my creativity, so to speak, was being stilted, and I wanted to do something where no one could tell me that I couldn't do it. So I started to work on trying to get all of his recordings for a tribute program. I think I got the idea from the fact that we constantly do festivals, and also from the fact that, like the Sergei Rachmaninoff said of RCA Victor, he could not have made that many recordings that I couldn't play them all, assuming I could find them. So then I went around trying to find out what recordings he had done, and I found that nobody knew what recordings he had done, so I had to. That's a little bit unfair, because David Hall did do a preliminary discography, which was very helpful to me, especially in my early stages, and this is how I learned to a great extent how to do a discography, and this is how I've done. Of course, that radio program has never been done yet. I've only worked on the discography. The radio program eventually will be done, I hope, before I'm too old to appreciate it, but I'm still in the planning stages or something like that. Anyway, the topic of this talk is Emanuel Feuermann, and I would like to talk about him to some degree, or spend most of my time talking about him. Just to give a little historical background, he was born November 22, 1902, in Colomea, Galicia. The discography says Galicia, Colomea, but this one's right. And that's really in what would have been called Poland at that time. It's got a very interesting history. I won't go into it to a great extent, but it was in part of the Austrian Empire, had been considered part of Poland in and out, would eventually revert back to Poland, and now is part of the Polish area that is in the Soviet Union. So he liked to refer, since he didn't want to think of himself as Polish, he liked to refer to himself as Austrian. most people today would think of him as being a Polish native. In any event, his parents were Meyer and Rachel Honigsberg Feuermann. His father was an amateur cellist, not especially good, but very full of drive and always looking for the right break to get ahead. He had one older sister named Gusta, an older brother named Zygmunt, and the younger sisters Rosie and Sophie. I'd like just for a second to talk about Zygmunt Feuermann, who I'm sure that almost none of you have heard of. Zygmunt Feuermann was a violin prodigy, a little bit older than his brother, 2 years older to be exact, and was considered one of the great prodigies of all time. He was a 10-year-old Wunderkinder who had studied with Ottokar Sevcik, one of the great violin pedagogues of the time, along with Leopold Dauer. They used to have contests to see who could turn out the better prodigies. One of the prodigies turned out by Sevcik, or his first, was Kubelik, who many of you would have heard of. He also taught Erika Marini at the same time he was teaching Zygmunt Feuermann. And at the time, Emanuel Feuermann used to tag along and try and learn from some of the lessons as well. But in any event, he was, as I said, a 10-year-old Wunderkinder when he gave his inaugural recital in 1910 in the Academy in Vienna, and later that year played the Brahms Violin Concerto with Felix Weingartner and the Vienna Philharmonic to absolutely sensational reviews. He was considered one of the very best at this time and continued to grow and mature, but then around the 1920s, he seemed to have some psychological problems. His father especially pushed him very, very hard and really was his total personality. He withdrew completely into himself, did go to America to live and teach at the New York College of Music for a while, but basically stopped concertizing in the 1920s, never made any recordings, so we don't know what he sounds like today. And he became somewhat disassociated when he did play, which was very infrequent, later moved to Israel and died around 1952. Now to return to Emanuel Feuermann, growing up, understand now, with an older brother who was considered the prodigy, and at that time, he was not really that highly thought of as a talent. His father taught him up until about 1910, but he taught him without much intensity, without much pushing. He was spending most of his time trying to set up things for the older brother, Zygmunt. And then his father realized that he ought to get some outside training, so he was given to Frederick Buchsbaum, at that time the cellist of the Rosé Quartet, but he was only with him for less than a year. Buchsbaum was a rather uncompromising sort of man, and Meyer Feuermann was also of the same type of person, and they really didn't get along all that well, so we switched him to the more malleable Anton Walter, who interestingly enough would later become the cellist of the Rosé Quartet, although at that time he was cellist of the Fitzner Quartet. This is again about 1911, and he's only about 22, 23 years old at the time, and this is Walter who I'm referring to. After that, there was not any tremendous progress made by Feuermann. His playing was rather good. Walter was impressed with certain things that he did, but nothing overwhelming. And around 1913, maybe late 1912, Pablo Casals came to play in Vienna, and Emanuel Feuermann and some members of his family went to see him play the Boccherini B-flat cello concerto and the Haydn D major cello concerto. And Feuermann, who knew the Boccherini, had never heard the Haydn before and fell completely in love with it, insisted that the music be bought for him. It was, and he learned to play it all by himself, which no one had exactly expected. He had really, prior to that, been seen as liking the cello as a plaything and used to, as it's referred to, noodle a lot around on the cello and had trouble being forced to practice. He never would practice more than about 2 hours a day. And used to, and one of the stories goes that he and his brother, when no one was looking, would make their instruments into little wagons by putting a string on the cello and pulling it around. But in any event, after this, the parents and others began to realize that perhaps they had another budding prodigy in their midst. They may not have been that aware of it at that time, but they were aware something was going on because he showed tremendous drive to just learn this piece all by himself without any teaching at all, and he learned it with some degree of stylistic ability as well, and we're talking about a 10-year-old at this point. His debut recital actually took place later that year, fall 1913, in a small hall in Vienna. He was age 11 by this point, and his official debut was the Haydn Cello Concerto, playing that work with Weingartner and the Vienna Philharmonic. This is February 1914. And by later in that year, he and his brother Zygmunt are playing the double concerto with Weingartner, and later they play it all over mostly Germany and Austria. But throughout Europe, this is just prior to the war. When the war breaks out in full force, they're forced basically to stop concertizing, at least on a major scale. And some feel that this may have caused some of Zygmunt's problems because he was not allowed to grow in any particular way, but that's a totally different issue. Around July 1917, the family had to decide what they wanted to do with the budding young prodigy, at this time age 14. And they had to decide whether they wanted to send him to a cello pedagogue, but they couldn't decide which one. The choices were Julius Klengel and Ugo Becker of Berlin. Klengel, at this time in Leipzig, and he spent all his career in Leipzig, so it wouldn't be at that time. But they finally decided on Klengel, who, just to give you an idea of the cellists he taught, for those of you who had heard of some of these, Gregor Piatigorsky, Alfred Wallenstein, Misha Schneider, Paul Grummer, Joseph Schuster, Wilhelmina Sugia, a number of others. So he was considered, perhaps today, the cello pedagogue along the lines of, again, people like Leopold Auer. So it was probably a very beneficial choice that he went there. Klengel played in the Gewandhaus Orchestra for 50 years. His grandfather had done the same, playing at the time of Mendelssohn, and he had wanted to set the record for most years playing with the orchestra, but Fernd Fengler, who took over the orchestra at that time, ended that possibility. Klengel actually would say that Foreman was the greatest cellist. He would say it almost immediately that Foreman was the greatest cellist that he ever taught. I tend to agree, but I'm prejudiced in this instance. And then a very interesting thing happened. Foreman was 16 years old in 1919, and at that time, Professor Friedrich Grützmacher, Jr. of the Grützenische Conservatory in Cologne, Germany, passed away at the age of 54. And they went to Klengel, who was the authority. Who do you want? We want someone to take his place as a professor in the university. He recommended 16-year-old Emanuel Feuermann, and they were aghast. They said, "This is a joke. We don't appreciate it." And he said, "No, it's no joke. You should audition him." So they auditioned him, and he started laughing at some of their antics while playing in the quartet, because at that time many of the instrumentalists tended to slide a lot more than we're accustomed to now, and he thought it rather amusing that they were making what he considered all sorts of mistakes, and that this time they were auditioning him for the job rather than the other way around. He perhaps didn't quite think so. In any event, they realized that this was a talent they couldn't quite pass up, so they compromised after a fashion. They gave him the job, but refused to give him the title of professor. They didn't want to give someone who was 16 and younger than the students he'd be teaching a job as a professor, but they did give him the professor's salary. However, I don't remember what I was going to say, so I won't go into that. Just to continue, Feuermann liked to tell a favorite story of his that happened when he was a professor in 1919. This is one of his favorite stories. I think it is a very good story about him. He was traveling on a bus, and a fellow passenger saw his cello, because of course he was carrying it around, and he told him, "Look, if you study real hard and practice, you may someday be able to approach the great young cello teacher at the university." So he always found that story rather amusing. I don't think he told the passenger who he was. I think he decided to leave him in doubt. At this time, actually, let's say about a year later, Feuermann, who would be living in Cologne with his older sister Gusta, was adopted, so to speak, by Paul and Oma Riefenberg. This was a wealthy, formerly Jewish family in Cologne, and he would live with them on and off for a number of years after that, and later married the youngest daughter, at this time only 5 years old, named Eva, in 1935. Around 1923, in the summer, it was decided that he couldn't stagnate by continuing to teach in Cologne, and that he should begin to concertize. So he started to plan for European tours. At that time, made his first trip to London. Earlier ones had been planned, but the war had intervened, and he gave his debut there at Aeolian Hall to rather complimentary reviews, certainly nothing ecstatic, but rather complimentary reviews, and was also concertizing mostly through Germany, Austria, Poland, even Russia a couple of times. His first recording was made at the age of 19. This is while he's still at the Gershwin East Conservatory. This is December 1921 for the Berlin Parlophone Company. This was the Haydn Cello Concerto, the second and third movements in a truncated one-record version. Of course, this is one of the few records I haven't found. So I'll mention that at the end, so in case any of you come across it, you can let me know. But this is with Frieder Weissmann and the Berlin State Opera Orchestra, at least we think it's the Berlin State Opera Orchestra. And the interesting thing about Weissmann, who many of you would have heard of, is that this is one of his first recordings as well. You have a 19-year-old cellist and a 20-year-old conductor doing that work. It'd be very interesting to hear what they sound like at that time. Getting back to 1923 again, at this time, Feuermann, who knew Bruno Walter pretty well, asked him if he would mind joining with him and his brother Zygmunt in forming a piano trio. And they did, and they gave a couple of tours, again, mostly throughout Germany, around Berlin and Cologne. Not all that successful. Bruno Walter's playing style was a little bit older than what the Feuermann brothers were accustomed to, and especially on the piano. And so while they were parted amicably, it did not work all that well. But Feuermann was mostly concertizing on his own. He gave an approximately 50 to 70 solo appearances a year between 1923 and 1929. And when you realize that he was traveling in as many as 300 different communities, mostly by train, this is a rather startling amount of concerts to be giving every single year. But during this time, after having praise heaped on him time and time again and getting tired of playing all these concerts, Feuermann's playing became sometimes not all that great. He was somewhat lazy, didn't always practice, and he sometimes didn't play all that well. There's a famous story, again, this is one that Feuermann liked to tell many years later. This is 1927 in Switzerland. He was playing a piece, and Toscanini was sitting in the audience, and Toscanini was yelling, il porco, which means the pig, the pig. And there's a postscript to this story. When he met Toscanini again in 1938 and played at the May Festival, which I will in London, which I will describe a little bit later, he told Toscanini, you know, I played before you before. And he said, I've never heard you before. And he said, yes, and he said, and told him the story. And Toscanini said, you mean you were that rotten cellist I heard in Switzerland? In any event, we'll get on to what happens in May of 38 later. In October 1929, Feuermann decides to go back to teaching again. And part of the reason for this is Ugo Becker, who we discussed before, the Berlin Hochschule, decides to retire for reasons that are interesting but need not be expressed here, at least not right now. And he wanted to become professor at that school, and through a little bit of string pulling, or that's really the wrong choice of terminology, but a little bit of buttering up the people in charge would be a better way of putting it, he was able to get the job. And one of his fellow professors was a violinist named Joseph Wolfstahl. And he and Wolfstahl and the pianist Leonid Kreutzer formed a piano trio at that time. In the next year, in 1923, Kreutzer decided to go abroad with Piatigorsky and with Milstein. And so he was replaced in the piano trio with Paul Hindemith, the violist, as a string trio. And they made some important recordings, which we will talk about just a little later. Going back to recordings just for a second, Feuermann did make a good many recordings for the Parlophone label. That was, as I said before, the first recording that he did was for Parlophone. He continued to make recordings up until 1930. The important recordings are the Dvorak Concerto, made in May of 28 and October of 29. The orchestral accompaniment is very poor, and the sound quality is not tremendous, but still an important work, and it is an important milestone. As far as I know, though I'm probably wrong, it's the first electrical recording of that work. Casal's recording, which is much better known, made with George Sell, was made in 1937, which is a good 8 years later. But the last the other important recording was made in 1930. February of 1930 was the Bruck Kol Nidre. It's the only time he recorded that work. He did not play it often in concert. It is a truncated version, and frankly, I'm sorry, it's a little long. We can't play it today because it's very beautifully played. But that, as I said, done around February 1930, and that's the last recording he makes for Parlophone. Although, in speaking to Frieder Weissmann, he told me that he and Feuermann contracted together to make a recording around 1933, and then Hitler took over and Feuermann left. Now, I don't know if that was for Parlophone, but I presume it was, since that's the label that Weissmann was associated with at that time. And I also don't know what the work was, and Weissmann's memory was sort of shaky. So I won't guarantee that that's true, but the chances are there's some validity in that. In any event, the last German recording was made in September 1932 with Paul Kletzky in the Berlin Philharmonic. This is the Popper Hungarian Rhapsody in D, Opus 68. It's, again, a truncated version. Sound quality is phenomenally good for this time. The Telefunken recordings are very fine sounding around 1932. Now, there are a lot of questions about this recording. Why was it done? It's the only recording, apparently, he made for Telefunken. It's just two 10-inch sides. There had nothing else done at that time. He seems to have no reason to have gone to the studio. He had not been to the studio for 2 years and would not go again for two more years. And it's just sitting there in the middle of everything. I don't know why. I have not found out why he recorded it. The Telefunken company knows very little about it, except that it's listed in a catalog. I haven't found out if there was anything else, but I do know that's all that was issued. In any event, I'd like to play at least part of that recording for you here this morning, just so you can get a feel. Now, just to describe the cello he's playing the Domenico Montagnana cello, which most of the early recordings are with the David Techler cello. Just to try and describe the difference, the Techler cello was a little bit larger, much more heavier tone. This has a much more singing quality. It did not fare all that well for certain recordings, but for this one it came out very, very well, and I'd like you to hear it now. decided to fade it there. I hope you won't mind. It just is that it's a little long, and I'm running out of time. So I figure that at least you've gotten an idea of what his playing was like. In any event, just to return for a minute to the violinist Josef Wolfstahl, well, I didn't really talk about him earlier, and I think he deserves just a little bit of comment. He was a very highly regarded violinist living in Germany at that time, as I said, a fellow professor at the Berlin Hochschule, taught mostly by Carl Flesch, who had a bit of a rivalry with him because Wolfstahl's technique was considered that much greater, although Flesch, a great violin pedagogue and also a very fine performer, was perhaps a little jealous of his own pupil. In any event, Richard Strauss thought very, very highly of him, and there is one recording, although offhand I can't recall which one it is, where Wolfstahl is playing a violin solo in the orchestra. Thank you. One of the tone poems, thank you. In any event, as I said, Strauss thought a lot of him, but Wolfstahl would die of pneumonia in February 1931 at the age of 31. And I talked before about the string trio that Feuermann and Hindemith played with. They then had to look for a third member, and they chose the then 29-year-old violinist Zeman Goldberg, who many of you might be aware of is still alive today and still concertizing, though mostly conducting in the Netherlands, where he makes his home. At this time, he was concertmaster of the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra. They gave a number of concerts together, a great many, as a matter of fact. And they also gave a couple, or I should say three, live broadcasts, which were recorded. These were the Reger String Trio in D minor, Opus 141, on October 11, 1931, the Beethoven String Trio in C minor, Opus 9, number 3, on April 20th, 1932, and the Schubert String Trio number 2 in B flat, Deutsch Listing 581, on April 24th, 1932. These have not been found, but for those of you who are aware that the German radio station sometimes recorded either whole compositions or, in this case, portions of their broadcasts on live shellac discs, there is a slight possibility they still exist somewhere, and of course those would certainly be very interesting to hear. In 1933, as many people are aware, Adolf Hitler took over as Chancellor of Germany, and Feuermann's position at the Hochschule was not renewed. It was on a yearly basis, and not surprisingly, though they didn't at that time kick him out, they basically told him he would not be invited back. Many of the students threatened to leave the school, and many of the professors did too, and they said, too bad, you can leave if you want. Most of them didn't, for whatever it's worth. He left Germany in July of that year, basically. He would go back twice, once in September of 1933, to play in some synagogues for some rather frightened Jews who were asking him to play for their morale. This was a secret concert. It was not illegal for Jews to play in Germany at that time, but the Nazis would attempt to break it up at any opportunity they could, so they were not informed or invited. And he would go back again in October 1937, just passing through Berlin. But in any event, in January of 1934, this string trio that we've been talking about, Hindemith, Feuermann, and Goldberg, were making a tour of London, and they would be going on to Belgium and Italy. And they also made a series of recordings for English Columbia. English Columbia, at this time, they were very anxious to get this trio on disc because Hindemith was still a native and a resident of Germany. And they were afraid that he might, although not Jewish, he might have trouble traveling back and forth. And so they wanted to get them as soon as possible onto disc. Earlier that month, I won't swear to it because I don't have the date with me. No, as a matter of fact, I'm wrong, so I'll go to that in a minute. All right. The recordings, just to give you a little background, on January 20th, Hindemith and Goldberg made a recording of a string duo of Mozart, the second Kerschel Listing 424. Now, on January 21st, they did the second Hindemith string trio. This was written the year before for their concert use, and one of the rather amusing stories about that work is one time when they were practicing, Hindemith had a little trouble playing his work, and so Feuermann and Goldberg chided him, saying, "Composers ought to write things that us performers can play." And then on January 22nd, they recorded the Beethoven Opus 8 Serenade. Both the Hindemith String Trio and the Beethoven Serenade, to me, are among the finest recordings of these works. The Hindemith would not be surprising since, as I said, this was written for them and was played by the composer. The Beethoven, perhaps a little bit of a surprise, but certainly one of the finest recordings, perhaps, as far as I'm concerned, the finest recording of that work ever done. Interestingly, the Mozart duo, I don't think is all that well played. That's a little too sweet sounding on Goldberg's part, and Goldberg and Hindemith don't really mesh that well in the recording. It's interesting, but I certainly don't think it's a masterpiece. But what I'm going to play for you is the last recording that they did as a group. This was made January 23rd, the next morning, and there's a very interesting little story about it. For some reason, which I've been not able to ascertain, the reason that Goldberg gives is not accurate, which is that they had an empty side to fill, because each of the sets fills up an even number of sides. But in any event, they had a side they wanted to fill up, and it would only be about 3 or 4 minutes, and they informed him there's no string trio that's that short, and Goldberg had to leave anyway the next day, so Hindemith, with a slight grin on his face, said, all right, I'll write one overnight. So he wrote it overnight, and he informed some of his friends, without telling Feuermann, that he was going to make it so difficult that he couldn't play it. So then Hindemith brought it in for Feuermann to play, and he learned it in a half an hour. It's a magnificent work. For those of you who don't like Hindemith, it's still a magnificent work to listen to, with the tremendous fiddling, if that's an acceptable term in this instance, and the tremendous tempo at which they take it. If you ever hear another recording of this, and I must admit, I've only heard one, it's taken about 1/3 the speed. This is a fabulously fast and incredibly difficult work, and I'd like us to hear it now. It's a Hindemith Scherzo for viola and cello. Thank you. Thank you. That whistle was not part of the recording. I should mention, as David Hall was kind enough to point out, that this was issued in the Columbia of History of Music, Volume 5. This is the last volume, For Eye and Ear. This was the volume of basically 20th century works. It was not, I don't believe, recorded for that purpose. It might have been. It's really rather difficult to be sure. It was one of the earlier recordings in that set, because it was made in 34, and the set, most of the recordings in the set date from about 1936. But it was issued in that set and received very widespread circulation because of that, although it has never been issued on LP. Anyway, 1934 marked Feuermann's first trip to Japan and the United States. The Brahms Cello Sonata in E minor, opus 38, and the Beethoven Magic Flute Variations without opus 46, and the Gluck Melody from Orfeo and Eurydice were recorded in England, but they were recorded for Japanese consumption, at least originally, though with the exception of the Brahms Sonata, they were issued in England before they were issued in Japan. But the Japanese were rather wily businessmen and wanted him to record something specially for them before he got there, though many of his parlophone discs were issued there as well. In going to Japan, this is around October, November 1934, he was traveling all over the Far East, including Singapore, Java, China, and other places as well. And this was a world tour to a degree, so when he finished in November of 34, he started his trip toward North America. His North American debut took place November 28th in Vancouver, and he would later go via Los Angeles to Chicago to New York. Many people hear that his American debut was January 2nd, 1935, with the New York Philharmonic Symphony. That's not quite true. That was his New York debut. It was his first, it was a major debut, but it was considered the way a Broadway play would open in Philadelphia and then go to New York. The other concerts given in the United States were considered tune-ups, but the January 2nd concert, where he played the Haydn Concerto with Bruno Walter conducting, was not his American debut. As a matter of fact, after that concert, he received very fine reviews, but they certainly were not ecstatic. Owen Downs' review was very, very qualified at that time. And just a little bit later that month, on January 14th, 1935, he gave a town hall concert where every cellist who was interested in cello playing, who hadn't heard him or who had, was in the audience, and they were about it. Town hall was about half filled. The critics were there as well, and their reviews were absolutely ecstatic this time. There was not one qualification. There had been an error. Samuel Chatsunov wrote a review at that time of the first concert and made an error about Foreman's nationality, not only corrected the error, apologized for it, and said that without any question he had never heard a greater performance by a cellist. This made NBC managements realize that they had a reasonably hot property on their hands, and they tried to look for an open date where he could be rescheduled. They kicked somebody out who they never did find out. I haven't found out, and he didn't know. And on February 15th, he gave a return engagement, this time to a filled town hall, and again, the reviews were ecstatic on his trip. After this, he would make repeated trips to the United States every year. He came back in December 1935, January 36, and would come back in 37, and came to live here in 1938, but I'll get to that in just a moment. He lived mostly in Zurich up until 1938, spending a lot of his time in London, and had hoped for a long time to make London his home. But the response of the populace to Feuermann in London was lukewarm at best. Casals was the rage in London, and the London public is apparently renowned for being slow to warm to certain artists, or to a lot of, especially foreign artists. You could correct me on that. And his reviews were very good, occasionally qualified. His concerts were usually filled, but not always. And then on May 23rd, 1938, he gave a concert in the May Festival in Queen's Hall in London with Arturo Toscanini doing Don Quixote of Richard Strauss, which was an absolute sensation. And the reviews, again, were unqualifyingly superb. And they basically, at this point, I suppose, as somebody once put it, realized what they had. But since we're also very near the war at that time, he was almost planning to leave because he realized what the situation was in Europe and was planning to come to the United States at that point, so it was a little late. There is a recording that survives of that broadcast. There's a shortwave recording of the Don Quixote, which is in pretty poor sound, and there may be another source to it. The Italian Cetra label has issued that particular recording. I've not been able to find a copy of that record, and it may be from EMI Experimental Discs. Fred Gaisberg of EMI used to record Toscanini concerts without letting him know about it, because he was hoping some of them would be good enough quality that they could convince him to issue them. Fortunately, none of them were, but many of them do survive today. This may be one of those. It's difficult to say, or it may just be the shortwave, or may have been someone else who recorded it. I just don't know. However, later that year in October, Foreman repeated this performance with Arturo Toscanini, this time with the NBC Orchestra. This is not considered quite as good a performance. I've heard both of them. I happen to think the BBC one is better, what I can hear of it. And the 8H acoustics are not all that great, but the critics were very pleased with it, and I'd like to play the very ending, what's called The Death of Don Quixote, from that performance, which I think will give you an idea of what their playing was like together. Arthur Rubinstein was once quoted as saying, after hearing this work with Feuermann, that he never wanted to hear it again with another cellist, and he hadn't realized how beautifully that it could be played. And I think that this is a demonstration of that right here. Anyway, I'd like to backtrack just a little bit back to 1935 for a second. 1935 marked the time that Feuermann got his last cello that he would get, and a cello that was called the last cello, made by Stradivarius. There's some question as to whether it really was, that it was really made by Stradivarius or whether it was his last cello. But the answer is probably it was not one of, it was one of the last ones, and it was made by Stradivarius in any event. Also called the De Monk cello, and it was a very small cello, 29 and a half inches, which Feuermann much preferred. And when I was at the Library of Congress, I remember trying to find out whether Feuermann had ever played there, because it seemed likely that this would be one of the places he might have given a concert. And it turns out, according to the people that I spoke to there, that the reason he had never given a concert there was that they wanted him to use the Whittall instruments, and that while he thought that they were great instruments, they were really too large for him. He didn't really want to use them. And so he might have eventually given one had he lived longer, but he never ended up giving a concert there. Just to try and move quickly ahead, he would tour Japan again in April of May of 1936, and in February of 1938, he doing a marathon series of cello concerts given in Carnegie Hall, series of five concerts in which he played 14 concerti. Some of you may remember that Rostropovich repeated that stunt many years later. In about 1967, he gave a series of concerts of 16 cello concerti. I wonder if there was a reason for choosing two more, but one of these was broadcast by WMYC in New York. Not surprisingly, it hasn't been found. Another one, part of one, may have been found. I list that in my discography, but due to lack of time, I don't really want to go into the details. He moved to the United States in October 1938 and to become a citizen, and did get his first citizenship papers at that time. And of course, that's the month that he plays with Toscanini and the NBC Orchestra. His last recordings for the English Columbia Company were because of a previous contractual commitment. He would record the Reger Suite for an unaccompanied cello, which, for those of you who've heard it, will be amazed at how much it sounds like Bach, and many people feel that it gives a good indication of what Feuermann would sound like if you were playing Bach, though there is a snippet of a Bach suite from an encore he gave at Lewiston Stadium that does exist. He also played, at that time, short pieces by Drigo, Cui, Rimsky-Korsakov, and Albani. His first recording for RCA was January 14, 1939, where he made some recordings with, believe it or not, a trio of Serkin, Elman, and Hululashanska. These were done for the benefit of an endowment, and he would later start his recordings in August of that year for good for RCA. The important RCA recordings are the Mendelssohn Cello Sonata, recorded September and December 1939 with Franz Rupp, Brahms' Double Concerto with Heifetz and Ormandy, the Richard Strauss Don Quixote with Ormandy and the Philadelphia, and the Bach Shlomo with Sikorsky in the Philadelphia. Interesting thing about the Shlomo is that Sikorsky only made three recordings with, well, actually not three, but he only did it with two artists where there was an artist on the program with him, three times with Sergei Rachmaninoff in his own music, and this one time with Emmanuel Feuermann. So that's obviously an indication of what Stokowski thought of playing with Feuermann at that time. The Heifetz, Rubinstein, and Primrose mixtures that Feuermann recorded, all of which are available, by the way, were recorded in August and September 1941. That's not true, actually. There's a Feuermann-Primrose duet that is not available at present, but it has been issued on LP. And interestingly, RCA got the idea because those musicians and others used to play in their summer homes in the Los Angeles area just for fun. And RCA found out about it and decided to record them. In fall 1941, he was named the head of the chamber music department at the Curtis Institute in Philadelphia. In May 19, 1942, he went into the hospital for the removal of hemorrhoids. Many people know that when you sit a lot, you tend to get hemorrhoids, and cellists are prone to them. And he went to have them removed, not really telling very many people, including not telling his sister. And there are a lot of reports as to what happened. None of them are completely verified. The truth is probably they gave him morphine. He was allergic to it, and he died. and just for the simple removal of some hemorrhoids. But in any event, obviously, dying at the age of 39, interestingly enough, like Fats Waller, who was talked about just a few days ago, caused a tremendous shock throughout the country, and all sorts of letters were written. There's an article in the New York Times shortly thereafterwards by Joseph Schuster, who was first cellist of the New York Philharmonic, also first cellist of the Berlin Philharmonic earlier than that. Feuermann had planned to play the Bach Viola da Gamba sonatas for viola da gamba and harpsichord, and he was learning how to play the da gamba, and he was going to play it at the New Friends of Music concerts, but of course he died, and they dedicated their next season, 1942-43 season, to him. He'd also planned to record the Haydn Cello Concerto with Eugene Ormandy. This is shortly after the time he passed away, probably in May of 1942, but he passed away before that could be done. Just to give you an idea of who was at the funeral, and many of them played at the funeral, they included Toscanini, Schnabel, Erica Marini, Elman, Zimbalist, George Sell, Olin Downs, Huberman, Barzin, Serkin, Ormandy, etc. And one of the unfortunate things, in addition to everything else, is that the whole family was, to a great extent, a tragedy. The mother of the clan, and I said before there were five children, died after every single one of the children had died, with the exception of one. She would die in 1964, and every one of them was dead by then, with the exception of Sophie, who's still alive. Sophie is a piano teacher and very fine pianist, and she used to accompany her brother frequently on some of his early concert tours. Well, just to conclude, I'd like to mention some of the people that Feuermann played with during his time. He played with Schnabel and Huberman. They formed a trio together, and as a matter of fact, they were supposed to record the trio in 1939 in England, but the war intervened, and so they never got around to that. He also played with Rudolf Serkin. Many people know he played with Gerald Moore and with Franz Rupp, also with Ivor Newton, British pianist, and with Myra Hess, with George Sell, both as conductor and on the piano, with Joseph Zigeti, with the conductors such as Weingartner, Furt Wengler, Walter, Toscanini, Stokowski, Beecham, Sell, Frederick Stock, people like that. I'd like to mention just quickly some comments that some performers gave about Feuermann in interviews, interestingly enough, not done by me. In some cases, you can understand why. The first one was with George Sell. I think you understand why I didn't do it. Sell referred to Feuermann's subtlety of phrasing as trying to say what Feuermann did that was so distinct. He also talked about the dexterity of the left hand, and for people who are cellists, you know that the dexterity comes from the right hand. But he was saying, while that sounds stupid, it's something that in either seeing or hearing him play, you would understand. Zeman Goldberg harped on the uniquely Feuermann tone, and also mentioned two things which I think are very interesting and which I think bear repeating. He said he had the instinct for what can't be learned, and he had the ability and will to learn what can be learned, and that's what made him such a unique cellist. Arthur Rubinstein was quoted as saying that he was the greatest cellist of all time, and he led me onto what music really means. And he was referring to, as I said before, that Don Quixote recording as the first time he heard Feuermann, and this was his appreciation of it. I'd like to just mention some of Feuermann's personal traits. He was known for a very sarcastic sense of humor. He liked to deflate big egos, and having one himself, of course, as most musicians must. And he was somewhat childlike, but some of this was a defense. He was a very generous person and a musician, and had tremendous musical integrity. To give some musical traits, the magnificent tone, which I've mentioned, which you've heard, very brisk tempo. Not something that feels wrong when you hear it, but if you compare it to Casals, while this is not a criticism of Casals, mind you, because many times I would personally agree with the Casals tempo, it is much slower and much more laid back in its playing. And the only person I can think of who Feuermann reminds me of in this degree to a great extent is Jascha Heifetz, and of course they played together, but this was true before that. Heifetz was also known for his very fast tempi, and their playing is very similar in that regard. He also had a tremendous range on the cello. He was one of the first to be able to play the cello in some of the recordings, not really demonstrated here, make it sound like a violin. He could reach that high up in the register, also very low to sound like a double bass, and you heard what he sounded like in the mid-ranges of the cello. Just to give a background on what recordings are still available, all the Heifetz recordings are available, which I said. There's a Seraphim issue with the Beethoven Sonata Number Three, Cello Sonata Number Three with Myra Hess, and the Schubert Arpeggione Sonata, the Weber Andantino with Gerald Moore, those two recordings, the Dvorak Concerto with Michael Tauba and the Berlin State Opera Orchestra, and the Haydn Concerto with Sargent are available on the Bruno Walter Society label or DiscoCorp, as are the Hindemith and Beethoven string trios, and the Strauss Don Quixote with Toscanini that you heard, along with the second movement of a Dvorak Concerto with Frank Black. There is a biography, which I have behind me for anyone who wants to look at it, done by Seymour Itzkoff, Smith College professor of Emmanuel Feuermann. It's called Emmanuel Feuermann Virtuoso, University of Alabama Press. I don't think it's a great work, but it's the only biography of Feuermann, and it's interesting, it is informative, not totally accurate, but it's certainly worth reading for anyone who wants to learn more about Feuermann. And just to finish, I'd like to just say a personal note. I want to thank all of you for having me down here, especially Kathy Logan and Tim Brooks, and also David Hall and Mike Gray for helping me with my discography. This is just a personal note. I'm very appreciative. I must admit, when I was invited down, I had no idea what I was going to say. I didn't decide till last night completely. I was always wondering whether Tim Brooks invited me down because he couldn't fill out the program or not, but I don't think I want him to tell me. And the last thing I have to mention, I promised myself I'd do this. There are two Feuermann recordings I can't find, and if you come across them, I'd appreciate your letting me know. They're both acoustics. There's the Haydn Cello Concerto I mentioned earlier. Get out your pencils, everyone. It's on German Parlophone P1298, and the Dvorak Cello Concerto Second Movement, English Parlophone E10482, and last one is that Italian Cetra disc, which is available now, so someone ought to be able to find it. And that's LL526. Thank you. Thank you.
If you want to get the tape for Bon Giovanni in Bologna in Italy, we'll supply. You can find their address in the gramophone.
Yes, I think someone actually told me that. Thank you. I have to look that up. Any other questions?
One interjection. I would mention one of my favorite Feuermann recordings, the Hindemith Solo Cello Sonata. I don't know whether that was reissued on LP or not.
It's been issued privately, but that's it. On Music Masters issued that recording. It's a very fine performance. That actually was not written for Feuermann. It was written in 1923, before they knew each other. But it's about 8 minutes long, and that's one of the reasons you didn't hear it today. But anyway, thank you very much. I'm sorry.
One comment. I'm surprised you didn't mention the interesting short film that he made of the Popper piece. Is it the same one that I saw it quite a long time ago, and mm-hmm. It's an astounding film to see. I have never seen a cellist that had such a visually perfect technique.
You should be aware of one thing, which some people who are dealing with films know of, and that is that the film and the music are not exactly the same. They were done at different times. This was almost always true whenever they made artist films. Heifetz made a number of films where this was true. The reason for that is because you can't get optimum sound and optimum picture at the same time. And I've been told by a cellist in London that if you look at the close-ups of the hand and the Popper spinning song, he's not playing the right notes, and he's apparently doing that intentionally, because everything else is right. But he's apparently showing off and playing the wrong notes deliberately.
It's the bowing in that film that is really so amazing, because it's absolutely symmetrical. You know, I play cello myself, and I just couldn't believe how pure his motions were, whatever notes he was playing at any rate.
Well, I would like to have shown that film, but the problem was, although I have seen it and actually have a tape copy of the sound, I was unable to get it today, and it's also a little long. And in addition, the other thing is, if you look at it, he looks a little bit cross-eyed, and this is because he always wore glasses whenever he played, and they wouldn't let him for this performance. And so he's looking sort of like this. But he's right. It's a fabulous film, and I did mean to mention it, and I'm sorry I didn't. And it's if ever any of you get a chance to see it, it's certainly worth seeing, because it's the only film of him playing, even if it is slightly phony. Thank you.